This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You might have heard this on your radio a couple of months ago. A guy talking about Apple and a visit he made to some of its Chinese factories.
And she listens to this and she says, "But you are not a businessman." And I say, "That's true. I am not a businessman." And she says, "And you aren't going to buy their products?" And I say, "That's true. I'm not going to buy their products." And she says, "You will lie to them." And I say, "Yes, Kathy. I'm going to lie to lots of people."
And you know what? He did. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 16th of March. Glad, as always, to have you with us. This was a big day for Apple. The iPad 3 went on sale today. Yet another retail and media coup for a company that's taken its share of media heat the past couple of months. A big series in the New York Times about conditions at the Chinese factories where Apple makes iPhones and iPads. A full hour on This American Life from a guy named Mike Daisy. An amazing, detailed story about his trip to some of those factories. It's a story he originally told in a stage piece, a monologue called The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs.
But I do know that in my first 2 hours of my first day at that gate, I met workers who were 14 years old, 13 years old, 12. Do you really think Apple doesn't know?
Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has been reporting on Apple's supply chain for years now, the factories in China and the abuses there. And when he heard Daisy's story, he said it just didn't sound right. So he tracked down Daisy's Chinese interpreter. He met her in front of the same factory she'd taken Daisy to. And Rob started asking questions. In a collaboration with This American Life, here's Rob Schmitz.
For years, reporters in China have uncovered a long list of problems showing the dark side of what it's like to work at factories that assemble Apple products. Mike Daisy claimed he encountered firsthand some of the most egregious examples of this history, all in just a 6-day trip he took to the city of Shenzhen. Here's one example from his monologue. It takes place at a meeting he had had with an illegal workers' union. He meets a group of workers who've been poisoned by the chemical N-hexane while working on the iPhone assembly line.
And all these people have been exposed. Their hands shake uncontrollably. Most of them can't even pick up a glass.
Kathy Lee, Daisy's translator in Shenzhen, was with him at this meeting. I meet her at one of the places she took Daisy, the gates of Foxconn.
Did you meet people who fit this description?
No.
So there was nobody who said that they were poisoned by hexane?
No, nobody mentioned the hexane.
I asked Kathy to confirm other details in Daisy's play, like the claim that the gates were patrolled by armed guards.
Did the guards have guns when you came here with Mike Daisy?
No, definitely no.
And with nearly every detail, the answer is the same.
No, This is not true.
Daisy claims he met underage workers at Foxconn. He says he talked to a man whose hand was twisted into a claw for making iPads. He describes visiting factory dorm rooms with beds stacked to the ceiling. But Kathy says none of this happened. Last week, together with Ira Glass, the host of This American Life, I confronted Daisy in an interview. I brought up the workers he says he met who were poisoned by N-hexane. I tell him what Kathy said. Kathy says that you did not talk to workers who were poisoned by hexane.
That's correct.
So you lied about that. That wasn't what you saw.
I wouldn't express it that way.
How would you express it?
I would say that I wanted to tell a story that captured the totality of my trip.
Did you meet workers like that, or did you just read about the issue?
I met workers in Hong Kong going to Apple protests who had not been poisoned by hexane but had known people who had been, and it was like a constant conversation that we were having about those workers.
So you didn't actually meet an actual worker who had been poisoned by hexane?
That's correct. Hexane.
Daisy apologized to Ira Glass for not telling the truth to him and his listeners.
Look, I'm not going to say that I didn't take a few shortcuts in my passion to be heard, but I stand behind the work. My mistake, the mistake I truly regret, is that I had it on your show as journalism. And it's not journalism. It's theater.
This American Life wasn't the only journalistic outlet for Daisy. For the past year, he's been in the news constantly. Newspaper articles, op-eds, magazine profiles, online news sites. He's made numerous television appearances, CNN, C-SPAN, Bill Maher. And he usually says things like this from an appearance on MSNBC a month ago.
I saw all the things that everyone's been reporting on. I saw underage workers. I talked to workers who were 13, 14, 15 years old. I met people whose hands have been destroyed from doing the same motion again and again on the line.
Making Apple products.
Yes.
What makes this complicated is that the things Daisy lied about seeing are things that have actually happened in China. Workers making Apple products have been poisoned by hexane. Apple's own audits show the company has caught underage workers at a handful of its suppliers. These things are rare, but together they form an easy-to-understand narrative about Apple.
People like a very simple narrative.
Adam Minter is a columnist for the financial news service Bloomberg. He spent years visiting more than 150 Chinese factories. He's writing a book about the global recycling industry. He says the reality of factory conditions in China is complicated. Working at Foxconn can be grueling, but most workers will tell you they're happy to have the job. He says Daisy's become a media darling because he's used an emotional performance to focus on a much simpler message.
Foxconn bad. iPhone bad. You know, sign a petition, now you're good. That's a great, simple message, and it's going to resonate with a public radio listener. It's going to resonate with a New York Times reader, and I think that's one of the reasons why he's had so much traction.
And Minter says the fact that Daisy has not told the truth to people about what he saw in China won't have much of an impact on how the public sees this issue. And Apple will continue to try to clean up its image. The company's hired an independent auditor to inspect its suppliers throughout China. Charles Duhigg is a New York Times reporter who helped write an investigative series on Apple's supply chain. He told us that it may be hard to track whether conditions are improving because Apple hasn't yet released data that can be compared on a year-by-year basis.
My understanding is that Apple has said that they are going to begin releasing essentially granular data. And so we're looking for that to test the claims that things are improving as a result of Apple going in and demanding changes.
And if Apple does become more transparent about its supply chain, that could mean a step towards better working conditions, something Mike Daisy has been fighting for all along. From Shenzhen, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
There's more of Rob's story on this week's episode of This American Life. The whole hour is going to be spent on Apple, China, and the lies of Mike Daisy. Shares of Apple didn't budge much today on Wall Street, which does kind of tell you a little something, doesn't it? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you've bought gas lately, the news today about inflation probably came as no surprise. The consumer price index rose last month, 0.4%. And that, on the face of it, doesn't sound like a whole lot, but it is, in fact, the biggest jump in 10 months. All right, this is now the point in most inflation stories where the disclaimer comes, where somebody, me, I guess, points out that gas and food prices are volatile. They can rise and correspondingly fall pretty quickly, which is great. But still, you got to buy gas and food. So today's inflation situation is reminding some of inflation from days gone by. Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
As a young child of the 70s, I can't say I remember much, but Federal Reserve historian Alan Meltzer does. Gas prices tripled at one point. Prices for everything inflated.
We got up to an average of 17%.
Paychecks struggled to keep up, and families suffered. It all began with the Nixon White House. It wanted money for the Vietnam War, and money in people's pockets. So, Meltzer says, the Fed printed more.
It was a politically motivated decision. It did get more growth initially, but it also produced more inflation.
Which proved hard to tame, and he fears policymakers are doing the same thing now. To control prices, the Fed can boost interest rates, unpopular economic spinach for a Fed chairman, until President Carter appointed Paul Volcker.
Volcker said to him, I'm going to be tougher on inflation than my predecessors. The interest rates got to 20% or more.
Former Fed Vice Chairman Alan Blinder remembers those interest rates from when he bought a car.
The bank wanted 18%, and I called up my local credit union, and they only were charging 10%. Because they hadn't yet adjusted, and I dashed over to get that 10% rate.
The high rates broke inflation by the early 80s. But to get there, Volcker upset developers who couldn't sell homes. At a speech this week, Volcker says even now, some walk up to him and call him an SOB. But others say,
my father bought government securities at 15%, which put me through college. Thank you very much.
Inflation today is just 3%, but inflation hawks see it creeping up, and they warn, do we really want to go through all that again? In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Paul Volcker's like 85. You can't call him bad names. Come on. It might be stating the obvious to say that Mitt Romney hoped to have the Republican presidential nomination sewn up by now. Instead, he's still out there slugging it out with Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul as well. It's politically tiring and, in practical terms, expensive. And it has changed how Romney is spending his time and money on the campaign trail. Marketplace's Eve Troeh has that story.
Go to MittRomney.com and you see this phrase at the top of the page. We have a moral responsibility not to spend more than we take in. That presumably applies to his campaign as much as it does the federal government. Dan Schnur heads the Institute of Politics at USC. He says Romney didn't expect his GOP rivals to last this long in the primary race. His leads in official fundraising and super PAC donations haven't sewn up the nomination.
Money in politics is a lot like money in poker. It doesn't guarantee you anything other than a seat at the table. Romney's financial resources have allowed him to bid a little bit higher, but money isn't determinative.
But money is what's kept the Republican battle going, Schnur says. And since Romney has to fight harder state by state, that means more spending for the nuts and bolts of his official campaign. More private jets, hotels, and motorcades. More big rallies.
Given the amount of money they're spending, of course, they've got to raise more.
Romney took a few days in New York this week to do just that. Instead of stumping in primary battleground states, he held fundraisers, like a lunch at the Waldorf Astoria. Red Apple Group CEO John Catsimatidis put that lunch together.
Just because you stop by New York and pick up a few million dollars in a day and a half doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's good business.
The lunch was planned for several weeks, he says, and not a direct response to recent primary results. Several Republican fundraisers interviewed today noted that President Obama is out raising money, and he doesn't even have any primaries to win. I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
Not like this was the roughest economic week in the world, but it has been pretty interesting. We had the bank stress tests, that big resignation from Goldman Sachs, one from me as well. Except I was kidding. Greg Smith, the guy from Goldman, was not. Here to talk about all of that and maybe a little bit more as well is our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore, also Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Heidi, let me ask you about people calling Paul Volcker names at the age of, 85, whatever it is. Are you worried at all about this inflation trend?
I think that we should be. I do feel bad for Paul Volcker. Yeah. Let's just take a moment and say that the man has accomplished a lot. But yeah, I mean, I think we should be worried. We're seeing more and more indicators of inflation, plus the most important ones, our own eyes. And we're paying a lot more for gas, for food. And at some point, that has to hit policy. I understand that the Fed right now is privileging things like, you know, the lower interest rates to help banks, to help the economy. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing inflation rising. They have to react.
So, well, Sudeep, what would they do if they were to react?
Well, they're going to have to be very careful in doing something like that. And one reason they're so cautious, and we've seen this week when the Fed used the word moderate instead of modest to describe right. the recovery, we thought that was a good thing and everyone should be excited. But one reason they're being so cautious about this recovery is oil prices being already high and getting higher, even if it's based on a strong recovery, is likely to put the brakes on the recovery. We're not going to see it taking off the way we really need to see it. So they're actually just going to wait as long as they can before they deal with something like that. They don't want to go into a scenario like Paul Volcker had to deal with in the early 80s, obviously. And so they're going to hold off as long as they can.
So, Heidi, let me take this and turn it a little bit sideways. You know, there's been this sort of subterranean discussion about the rate of GDP growth, how fast the economy is growing, versus the kind of job recovery we are seeing, because we're seeing a recovery in jobs, but not GDP. What might happen to upset that balance? Is there a way that we can keep adding jobs without an economy growing at 2 measly percent?
Yeah, everyone's predicting, a lot of the big economists are predicting this is going to be a slow recovery.
Right.
You know, and with the jobs thing, we still have to watch. It's only been, you know, 3 months or so. We really do have to watch that this is a consistent trend before we start worrying about GDP. But we're seeing other positive signs. For instance, companies are not sitting on cash piles as big as they used to be. They're investing money, and that is good because it means they're going to hire more and they're getting ready to contribute to the economy in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have to wait it out. It's a slow recovery. It's not going to happen instantly. We didn't get into it instantly.
Yeah. Sudeep, turning to the bank stress test that I mentioned, everybody, you know, the biggest 19 banks were tested. The top 15 passed. Notably, Citi did not by the hair of its chinny chin chin. Does it mean anything economy-wise?
It does mean a little bit. At first, it's an important milestone to show how far we've come from 3 years ago when banks were unprofitable and undercapitalized and we thought the world was falling apart, to this point now when most of the banks are passing stress tests that include a figure of 13% unemployment to show that they could get through something that severe. It also shows that we finally have, despite what people think about the banks and the public view of Wall Street is still pretty dim, we finally have a banking sector that is strong enough to support a real recovery. So if we actually have enough support in the rest of the economy, we're getting to the point where the banking sector can actually finally help instead of hurt what we're facing.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. It's a good one. Heidi, we'll use that bank being strong metaphor to get to Greg Smith, the guy from Goldman who went out in a blaze of glory. And the last word's going to go to you this week. And the question is, why did that matter, that very public resignation?
Because he spoke from within the Borg. You know, Goldman is known as...
Well, the vampire squid, as it were.
Exactly. It's known as this cult. You know, it has, you know, omerta like the mob.
Right.
And, you know, and he spoke. And that is important because it shows that he saw cracks in the armor that maybe... You know, he might be sort of the avenging angel visited upon Wall Street to get it to question its morals. Of course, that's kind of an optimistic reading of it.
Yeah, one would charitably say. Heidi Moore in our New York Bureau, Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal down in Washington. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you. Coming up, election 2012, it's education, stupid.
If our goal really is to revive this economy, we should start by getting as many students through college as quickly as possible.
But first, let's do the numbers. A mixed day, but a strong week on Wall Street. The Dow Industrial slipped 20 points, a tenth percent, closed at 13,232. The NASDAQ gave back a point, basically flat, 3,055. The S&P 500 picked up a point, a tenth percent, 1,404. For the week, the Dow gained 2.4%. So did the S&P. The NASDAQ added 0.2%. On the day the latest iPad hit stores, the hot tech stock wasn't Apple. Actually, it was the long-suffering maker of BlackBerry. Shares of RIM surged nearly 7% on rumors that Samsung Electronics might try to buy a stake in that company. As we told you, Apple shares stood still at $585 a piece, almost the same as the cost of a new iPad. By the by, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee is scheduled to hold a field hearing in Brooklyn, New York. It's called Failure to Recover: The State of Housing Markets, Mortgage Servicing Practices, and Foreclosures. And actress Glenn Close turned 65. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Our election coverage this week isn't so much about candidates and platforms and promises and campaign spending. It's about voters, actual people, and what's going to matter to them most come November. Today, Richard Hernandez and the state of higher education.
I'm a community college student in Los Angeles, and I want to hear the candidates spell out what they're planning to do to make higher education more affordable and more accessible. In California, public colleges and universities were hit hard by the recession. The state closed its budget gap in large part by slashing funding to higher education. Fees and tuition have risen as a result. At the community college level, fees have doubled and are set to increase again this fall. But despite the higher fees, schools are cutting their course offerings. Winter and summer sessions have been eliminated from many schools, and fewer classes are being offered during the regular semester. Many students are faced with the reality of having to extend their education plans by another semester or two, or even a year or more. This is especially tough on students hoping to transfer from community colleges to four-year universities. If you can't get into the classes you need to transfer, you can't transfer. We can best solve these problems by stopping the budget cuts for higher education. It's ridiculous that students across the country have less access to an affordable education. It's ridiculous that middle-income families don't know if they can send their children to college even though they've been saving for years. If our goal really is to revive this economy, we should start by getting as many students through college as quickly as possible so they can become productive members of society. I'm looking for a presidential candidate who understands the social and economic benefits of an educated workforce. Less crime, more community involvement, increased entrepreneurial activity, higher wages, greater purchasing power, all these things benefit society as much as individual students. We need a president who will reinvest in education, someone who will help students achieve their goals by making college more accessible and more affordable. Someone who won't be anything like the politicians who created our current predicament.
Richard Hernandez is, as he said, a second-year community college student here in Los Angeles.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
The music, movie, technology, everything else festival that is South by Southwest down in Austin, Texas, made news this week, and not necessarily in the best kind of way. A New York marketing firm rolled out a program using homeless people to sell wireless internet access. The mainstream media question here at first and elsewhere as well became, was that exploitative or not? We wound up talking to a guy from the firm who thought up the idea and one of the homeless hotspots. They set us straight, as did Steve Butcher from Mad River Valley, Vermont.
This is not an abuse of the underprivileged. It is a unique, maybe non-PC idea and a tried and tested theory. Help the homeless by offering opportunity. I hope that if I'm ever in their shoes, I am offered a similar chance.
James Rosenthal from Schenectady, New York, said exploitation wasn't the issue. It's our attitude. Our attitude.
Someone who's worked in homeless services, I'm not surprised the homeless hotspots made people uncomfortable. This project was a challenge to people to overcome their discomfort and get to know another human being.
Finally, our commentary series this week, asking regular people what they want out of this election. Immigration was the topic of the day yesterday. Our commentator said illegal immigration hurts the economy more than it helps it, since it takes jobs away from legal workers. John Seifer from Milford, Connecticut, says we just don't know. It takes serious research, he said, to determine if the cost of sending money back home and the cost of deportation outweighs the benefits of people who do pay taxes, but often don't claim the benefits they're entitled to because they're illegal. Write to us. We read them all. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says contact.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A note on the way out today, the stuff that didn't quite make the headlines comes to us the same way it always does, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Noonan, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Stacey Vanek Smith, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, Brendan, there's a town in Wales in the United Kingdom that's been having problems with teenagers loitering around their commercial district and committing petty crimes and things like that. So the police are trying to think of new things that they can do to deter them.
So they're finally going to carry guns?
No. They're actually going to try installing pink lighting.
That'll show them.
Well, apparently it might, because pink lighting, I guess, accentuates complexion problems. And so the idea is that it will humiliate teenagers who are maybe struggling with acne into fleeing the area.
So they might succeed in getting rid of the teenagers, but their whole town is going to be bright pink. So is that, like, really a victory?
Well, no. And there'll be a huge influx of six-year-old girls going through their princess phase.
Jennifer Collins, reporter. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
So there's this new game for the iPad. Apparently it's one of the first interspecies games, and you can play it with your cat.
Is it called Dangle a String?
It involved a little more code than that. It's actually called You versus Cat. It involves images of things cats like to eat, and they have to grab at them. You have to grab at those things, too.
And who's winning?
The cats are winning, Rico. There's a leaderboard online, and apparently cats are 100,000 points ahead right now.
Just what we needed, another way for cats to feel superior.
Sally Herships, reporter for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Google is going to replace our ringtones with ads. So if I call you and you have agreed to this service, I have to listen to ads and you get free minutes.
That seems so unfair.
Yeah, but there is a plus to this, which is that if telemarketers call you, guess what they have to listen to?
Nice.
Payback.
There is oh so much more where that came from. The radio show that Brendan and Rico do is called The Dinner Party. There's a link to their podcast on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that's it. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Friday. Today, the Dow gave back 20 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ lost a point, basically flat. The S&P 500 picked up that same point, 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. Deborah Clark is the executive producer of the broadcast. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager around these parts. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, here's a question for you. Is it possible to get by with zero cash?
I walk out of a hotel and the doorman grabs my luggage, throws it in the trunk of the taxi, and what am I going to do? I mean, I could ask him if he's on PayPal and PayPal him a few bucks, but it's a bit involved, and so I ended up stiffing one doorman.
Lame. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here on Monday. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.